Welcome to episode 14 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today my guest is John R. Weeks, who is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Geography at San Diego State University. And he's been like a father to me in large part because he is my father. So, Dad, thank you for coming on.
Well, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure to be here.
So your PhD is actually in demography, and working together, we found that putting political science and demography together has been kind of like the academic Reese's peanut butter cup, where, you know, these two things actually taste better together, or certainly at least I've learned a lot about sort of causal processes that I wouldn't have thought about otherwise. Now let me just start with a general question. Why is it that so few people, academics, but certainly in political science, often social science, but also policymakers, why do they pay insufficient attention to how demography influences politics?
Well, I think the problem with that is that demography happens typically in a relatively slow way. As death rates change and birth rates change and population grows age by age. So the only time that demographic things really happen quickly is in migration flows, which, and the main quick ones have to do with refugee flows. So that's why in this political year, refugees were on the agenda in the United States as they have been in Europe as well. So the typical politician doesn't have much influence over current demographic events, except, like I say, perhaps refugees. But what they forget to do is to react to prior demographic events. So that's really, you know, as you and I have discussed and written about, that's really the problem, is that the politicians have failed to take into account the fact that there are these demographic changes that are occurring that they have to react to. And politicians don't really like to react to things. You know, if you lower the tax rate or raise the tax rate, if you nationalize or privatize industries, things tend to happen pretty quickly. But if you're reacting to demographic change, you know, that kind of goes counter to the way I think most politicians want to think about the world.
And it seems, too, that even when they're reacting to demography or demographic change, they don't actually know that they are, right? Because with regard to refugees, I mean, how often do you hear policymakers talk about how demography is part of the refugee flows, part of the causal process of the refugee flows?
Yeah, you almost never hear that. That's a really good point, because it is the case that the demographic underpinnings of these refugee flows is virtually never discussed.
And then another thing that occurs to me in thinking about predicting is that even when governments pay attention to demography, like the Chinese, they're not very good at predicting what the actual consequences of these of government decisions are going to be on demography in the long term, right?
Well, no, that's right, because one of the things that happens, of course, is that governments don't have a lot of real control, everyday control, over the demographic lives of individuals, particularly surrounding reproduction. So if a couple decides to have more or fewer children, there's not very much that the government can really do about that. I mean, we've seen the horrific issues in China of forced abortions, you know, under the one child policy, which, you know, now has morphed into a sort of a modified two child policy. But, you know, there are very few countries that are willing to go that far in terms of trying to influence reproductive decisions. So by and large, when people make a decision about reproduction, the government doesn't have much control. So, you know, what are you going to do?
All right. Now, coming back to Latin America and immigration, how does demography help us understand Latin American immigration to the United States?
Well, what we have there is a situation where the real disparity between the age structures in the United States and Latin America came to came to the fore, particularly in the 1990s, where we had had a long, we'd had, you know, the baby bust that had followed the baby boom. And, although fertility starting to decline in Mexico and, particularly in South America, there was still a young age structure. And so there really was a demand for labor in the United States that was not being met by children being born in the United States. And so there was a surplus of children in Mexico, a deficit of young workers in the United States. And it was a natural fit. It was, to quote the title of our book, an irresistible force.
And it seems ironic too that in the current political climate in the United States, there's so much focus on undocumented immigrants, but that we actually have hit net zero. We've been at net zero for a while, so that a lot of the things people are concerned about was something that was happening in the past, and that the key problem, in fact, is much less than it was.
Well, that's absolutely the case, because, of course, the birth rate has dropped tremendously in Mexico, down very close to replacement level, right, basically at replacement level. The age structure in Mexico has changed. The economy of Mexico is pretty good, and it's been able to absorb now the young people. So there's not a big crush from not a big push rather from Mexico into the United States for jobs. In the meantime, though, what has happened is, and Doug Massey at Princeton is the first one really to point this out, is that the tighter controls of the U.S.-Mexico border have meant that people cannot go back and forth as freely as they used to be. So undocumented immigrants used to be able to come to the United States, meet the demand here, and then when jobs weren't available, they go back home to Mexico. Well, with tighter border controls and the cost of having to pay a coyote to get across the border, people have stopped doing that. So we have a large undocumented immigrant population, not really out of a consequence of people wanting to stay here, but people being forced to stay in the United States.
Yeah,
but they're not going to deport themselves, of course, because once they settle in, they get married, they have children, their children are U.S. citizens, they have a life that has been created in a very different way than if the border had remained a little more fluid.
Right, and I wonder too, I'm thinking you could hypothesize that if a Trump administration's policies really hit the Mexican economy the way a lot of people, including Mexicans, are afraid, you could actually have the effect of more Mexicans wanting to get to the U.S., and then if you have tighter control, then you have even more of that sense that people will get here and then they will stay.
Exactly. No, those will be almost certainly the unintended consequences. I mean, we see this in Central America. I mean, the consequence of deporting back to El Salvador a bunch of gang members has been to create even a higher level of violence, particularly in the youth population of El Salvador, which then says to people, we got to get out of here. Right. And so, you know, they move north, and the southern border of Mexico is relatively porous. So then they're obviously headed not to Mexico, but to the United States.
So immigration, as you said, is probably it's the most obvious manifestation of demographic change. But you can really think about it in a lot of other ways. So one of the things is that you had pointed out a paper to me about how Colombia was moving toward a replacement level. And so how do you see demography connecting potentially to the peace process in Colombia?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because if you look at the timing of the peace process, which started about 4 years ago, if I recall correctly, that was just about the time that fertility was hitting replacement level in Colombia. Now, you might say, well, you know, correlation is not causation. But in this case, I would say those two things are correlated in a causal way, because of the fact that if you go back 50 years when FARC got going, when the rebellion got going, at that time, almost 60% of the population of Colombia was under the age of 20. This is a consequence of the drop in the child mortality rate that, you know, the Western world has been able to spread that around the world, and everybody's happy that children are surviving. But at that point, the average woman in Colombia was having six children. And now all of a sudden, whereas, you know, in the past, only two of those children were likely to survive to adulthood. Now, almost all of them are surviving to adulthood. They're surviving through childhood, and you've got this big mass of unemployed young men. Now, you know, you and I have been young men. We know, you know, that's just a potential cause of problem everywhere in the world. I don't say that in a sexist way. It's just a fact. And what happened, though, was that over time, as women became educated, the whole population became educated, became more urbanized, women started having fewer children, more options in life, and the birth rate dropped. In fact, is looking at those same data that the young woman who wrote that paper was looking at the regional level, you can see that the fertility in the cities of Colombia has been well below replacement level for quite a while. And of course, that creates then sort of a vacuum into which rural youth can go to the cities and find jobs. And those demographic changes, I think, are the things that have dampened the need and the enthusiasm for rebellion out in the countryside and created a real desire on the part of the rest of the country to move on with life. Colombia is moving forward. And the FARC rebellion is in the past, and the demographics have essentially overtaken that.
Okay. And so a kind of a corollary question, as I was looking at that article on Colombia, is that what are the potential political effects in general of a country moving toward and then under replacement level? How does that change people's thinking?
Well, I think it changes people's thinking in the way that all of a sudden things are now possible. Because if you go back to an earlier era, say 50, 60 years ago in Colombia, or, you know, most places in South America, life was hard. Life was largely rural and life was hard. Women had kids and the children died and women died in childbirth and so forth. Now health and reproduction are under control. Everybody's got more control over their life, and they're more likely to be living in a city where the economic options are greater than they are just out in the countryside. And people are educated. They can envision a future for themselves that hadn't been there in the past. So low death rates and low birth rates and urban population, educated population, it's a whole different perspective on the world.
And yet it's indirect, right? Because people often are not even aware of why things have changed.
No, that's exactly right. The people themselves are not really aware. Politicians aren't aware. And so it's there underlying everything without people seeing it.
Right. Now, that's a case for Colombia where potentially demography helped toward push the country toward a positive outcome, but that's not always the case. So how would you see demography connecting to the crisis in Venezuela?
Well, in Venezuela, you have a situation where you also have a very young population. Fertility has dropped in Venezuela, but not as quickly as it has dropped in Colombia. And this is partly because the Venezuelan government has not been providing or at least allowing, because I don't think Colombia provides reproductive health care services, but they allow it. There's been more resistance to that in Venezuela. You've got even higher levels of teenage pregnancy in Venezuela than you have in Colombia, teenage pregnancy being kind of an issue throughout Latin America. But you've got a young population in an economy that is very, very dependent upon one resource, and that's oil. And so even though you've got a country with the world's largest known reserves of oil, when the price of oil dropped and the population was continuing to grow, and you've got, you know, more than a third of the population under age 20, people coming up wanting a job, wanting to get married and so forth, the resources aren't there anymore. And so when you have a growing population and a young population and you don't have any way for them to have a job and move ahead in life, you've got a problem.
And as we've seen in the I think it was the New York Times article about Venezuela too, is that a lot of this comes back to immigration, because when you have problems like that in a country, then people's response is, okay, well, I got to leave and find someplace else to go.
Well, that's right. And it kind of goes both ways, because for a while, Venezuela actually was attractive to migrants because the economy was good. As long as oil prices were going up and the number of people per gallon of oil being pumped was smaller than it is today, then things were better off. Now you've got more people with less oil being pumped or oil being pumped at a lower price. And people are saying, well, you know, there's nothing for us here. We have to get out. And so they're taking boats to Curacao, or they're trying to cross the border into Colombia. They're trying to get over to Brazil, whatever they can do. They want to get out. And that's a natural reaction.
Yet another case study is Cuba, which relates both to economic crisis but also to immigration, because one thing I had been reading was that Cuba has one of the lowest rates of in-migration in the world. And, you know, Venezuelans, when they're leaving Venezuela, are not trying to get to Cuba. I don't really know of anybody besides perhaps tourists who are trying to get to Cuba, and they don't plan to stay. So thinking about Cuba then, how does demography connect to Cuban politics, but also Cuba's relationship with the U.S.?
Well, I think that the situation with Cuba, of course, is who would want to go to Cuba? I mean, with a human rights record like Cuba has had, it's not really a place that anybody sees there being any opportunity. And I don't think migrants are welcome. I mean, people generally want to get out and go somewhere else. And of course, the economy of Cuba would have collapsed under its own weight long ago. As a consequence of population growth in an economy that couldn't really accommodate that growth, had it not been for the state sponsors, first the Soviet Union and then Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And now both of those are essentially out of the picture. And so Cuba faces what we might call, it's not an uncertain future, it's a very certain future of disaster if something doesn't happen, because the population has reached a peak of about 11 million. UN demographers project that it's going to go down. The population size is going to go down because the population is aging, and the birth rate has been below replacement level for quite a while. Now, here's a case where when Castro came in, the birth rate went up a little bit because people in the rural areas saw some hope, they thought, of a better future. What Castro did immediately was to legalize abortion and make contraception available to everybody, and the birth rate did plummet. But of course, the birth rate had been high, the death rate was dropping, and so there was this spurt of population growth that the Cuban economy could not deal with. And had it not been for being propped up by the Soviet Union, the Castro regime would have collapsed long ago under its own weight. But now that Fidel is dead, and I you know, he's obviously a very charismatic person, unlike his brother. So it's not sure exactly, you know, what Raul is going to do, but he's got to do something, because the Cuban economy and its demographics paint a picture that unless people come in, particularly American investors come in and rebuild the island, it's going to crash.
And in thinking about the effects of below replacement, how sustainable is a country's economy if it remains at that level? Because we see some countries that are at that level and they're trying to get people to have more children. Is that itself sustainable, or do you need to increase the fertility rate?
Well, that's a good question, and a question to which we don't really have a certain answer, because this is completely uncharted territory. But my own view is, and I've pushed this, and I know demographers in Europe have been pushing this idea too, is that instead of giving up on the older population, which is the general theme right now, well, we have an aging population, so we're just literally dead. the approach has been rather to say, okay, look, people, particularly in a modern economy where everybody's not out there having to wield an axe or a plow, people can keep working for much longer. So instead of people being on the public dole in retirement, what you need is for people to work longer and to encourage people to save when they're younger. One of the real problems that we have in this country, for example, is we have a culture of spending. We don't have a culture of saving. And right now, of course, with interest rates and banks being essentially zero, people are not inclined to save in the bank. You know, you risk your money in the stock market instead. So we need to rethink the economic structure and how an aging population fits into that. So rather than saying, oh my God, we need a lot of younger people, from the birth rate, we need to recognize that there are ways around that. And of course, we have a growing population in developing countries that isn't going to slow down, is not going to stop until at least the middle of this century. There's going to be demand from those people to take spots in the richer countries.
And in Cuba, if the economy, obviously we got to wait and see what happens with the Trump administration, but let's say the economy gets a little bit stronger, would we expect the fertility rate to go up? Would we expect it to get closer up to replacement level or not?
Well, I think we probably would, because one of the things that we see in Europe, for example, which was kind of a leader in below replacement fertility, one of the things we see in Europe is that fertility is inching up amongst better educated women. So women who have, maybe you might say, a little higher prospects in their life are actually more likely to have a second child than women who are still kind of struggling economically to keep up with everybody else. And so I do think that in Cuba, if the economy improves, we probably would see a rise in the birth rate. Now, could the Cuban economy handle that? Perhaps not. So in the end, that might result in more out-migration from Cuba as those kids came of age and said, oh, there are better jobs somewhere else.
Which could also be an unintended consequence if the Cuban government or any government specifically tries to get policies that get people to have more children, because then you are having more young people, but then the young people are not going to be able to be absorbed into the economy.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, you know, governments have relatively little control over people having more kids. With forced abortions, as China has done, you could theoretically, you know, keep the birth rate low. But by and large, it is couples or women themselves that are making the decision about what the reproductive rate is. And there's very little evidence that governments can do much to get people to have kids when they don't really want to have kids.
Okay. We are out of time. John Weeks is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Geography at San Diego State University. Also, check out his blog, Weeks Population, which connects to his textbook, where he's looking at all of these sorts of issues in Latin America and everywhere else, and then also on Twitter. So, Dad, thanks again.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.